You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's pod is with Sandra Matz, who is the David W. Zelaznik Associate Professor of Business at Columbia Business School in New York. As a computational social scientist, she studies human behavior and preferences using a combination of big data analytics and traditional experimental methods. She has a new book. It's called Mind Masters, the data-driven science of predicting and changing human behavior. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
But over time, Sandra Matz, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly.
So in the introduction to your book, and actually throughout the text, you talk about the village you grew up in Germany. Can you tell us about home?
Yeah, very happy. So it's really a tiny, tiny village. 500 people in the southwest corner of Germany with a name that nobody outside of Germany can pronounce. It's called Vogelsheim. And it was really this beautiful small spot in the Black Forest that I grew up in.
And the metaphor that runs through the book is you grew up in this small town, everyone knew everyone's business, right? Yeah. And so you get in trouble for something and everyone knows and they all that stuff. And what you relate this to is now this, I mean, you live in New York, right? Or you're
yes,
in a city, right?
I've left the village since.
You've left the village. But there's been a new village that's happened in the world of, you know, computers and social media and all that. So talk about that dichotomy.
Yeah, it's really interesting because my experience growing up in this village was really characterized by what you just mentioned, right? So you have these 499 other people living side by side with you and observing everything that you do. They know exactly what you do on the weekends, who you're dating, what your music preferences are, and so on. And as the good neighbors do, they use that knowledge to not only understand who you are, but also influence your life, right? So it's not just that they know who you're dating, they're also trying to influence who you're dating. And sometimes that understanding is really helpful because they can give the best advice because they know what you're hoping to accomplish in life, what your fears are, what your desires are. So really wonderful, personalized advice, but also it felt quite manipulative at times because people were pulling behind the strings behind my back in a way that I didn't have control over and certainly didn't always appreciate. And you're absolutely right in that, even though I don't live in that tiny village anymore, the argument that I've been making is that in a way we all live in what I think of as a digital village. So it's not my neighbors anymore who kind of observe and track every step that I take, but it's really algorithms and the data that we generate. So it's anywhere from your social media. So these very explicit identity claims. It used to be the bumper sticker on my car in the village, the poster that I put up, right? Me maybe dyeing my hair. And it's now social media. It's like what psychologists would call behavioral identity claims, actually. It's like all of the explicit signals that you send about how you want to see yourself, how you want others to see you, all the way to what we think of as behavioral residue, these unintentional traces that we generate as we interact with technology, ranging from your GPS records that get captured by your smartphone, your browsing history. So really the traces that you don't think about twice, but still they offer this really intimate window into your psychology, right? Into your habits, your preferences, your routines, your desires. And the same way that my neighbors could use that information to influence my choices in a way, algorithms can do the same today.
You know how you come up across a line or someone says something, it just resonates with you in the moment and it keeps coming back over and over again. So one of those on this podcast is a conversation we had with Nir Eyal, who's a terrific good friend. And he said in his book, I think someone sent him a note and said this, which is that it's not a superpower unless it can also be used for evil. Yeah, and I this is what I thought of when you were talking about psychological targeting. Yeah. So can you explain what psychological targeting is and how it can be used in both for good and bad?
Yeah, I think it's oftentimes the opposite way that we think about this. It's like we think of the evil side and then we might also think about the positive side. But psychological targeting, the way that I think about it at the most basic level, is really the ability of algorithms to both read from our minds, so take our data, understand our preferences, our desires, our motivations, and then in the second step, right into our minds. So that's when I think about influencing behavior, influencing choice, influencing the way that we feel about the world, the way that we think about a certain problem. So these two stages of like inside and then influence. And you're absolutely right in that any technology can be used in both ways. There's a saying that I really like from a tech historian, Melvin Krensberg, who said that technology is neither good nor bad, but it's also not neutral. And I think this last part is important, right? If you think about the ability to peek into people's personality, their mental health, and their desires, their values, that gives you a lot of power over maybe changing the way that they vote, changing the jobs that they pick, changing like which products they might be interested in, and changing the trajectory of their health and their well-being. So it's very easy to see how this can easily be manipulated, but there's also all of these very powerful ways in which you could say, well, there's so many things that we struggle with as humans when it comes to accomplishing the goals that we set for ourselves, right? It's anywhere from exercising more, eating more healthily, improving our mental health. And those are things that are difficult for us to do without any support. So the more I understand about your motivation and desire and needs, the better I can actually help you accomplish these goals.
Yeah, you tie this together really nicely in a line in the book where you say what you learn in the village is similar to what you can learn with psychological targeting. You say, quote, once I understood the game that was played and had a clear sense of what I wanted out of it, I learned to play it to my advantage. That's powerful because that's giving yourself some agency, which I think we all do have. We don't have to be an agent to AI.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's difficult. So I think I constantly go back and forth between, you know, I do think that there's like a certain ways in which we control our own data and we can manage it, but it's really an uphill battle, right? It's really difficult in the way that the current ecosystem is set up. It's not made for good choices. Like if our data is tracked by default and we have to opt out, it's just like a constant uphill battle. Nobody has the time to read the terms and conditions and fully understand it. So I think if we really want to give people a fair chance of using that control that they have wisely, I think there's so many things that we need to change in a way that makes it easier for them to make good decisions with the control that they have.
All right. Chapter one, let me ask you this question. Does Facebook understand you better than your spouse?
Yeah, that was the name of a paper and most of the media coverage around it, and published by one of my colleagues at the University of Cambridge. And so what they did, and this is now kind of 10 years ago. So you can imagine the algorithms by now with more data and so on have become even better. But what they looked at is the people people's Facebook's pages. So pages on Facebook that you can follow, whether that's the official page of CNN, Lady Gaga's fan page. So really these explicit signals of someone's interest. And they said, well, how good is a computer at taking the Facebook pages that you follow, at predicting your personality compared to other people in our environment who should actually know us pretty well? Because it's really, it's not trivial to say, well, how do we quantify the accuracy of a computer in a way that we can make sense of it? And so what she said is like, well, we have a good human benchmark, and human benchmark are people who spend a lot of time with us, should know us pretty well. How good are they at saying whether you think you're more extroverted or more introverted or more open-minded or more traditional compared to a computer who really only has access to your Facebook likes? And what she showed, and back in the day, 10 years ago, with a pretty simple algorithm, was that a computer, just by accessing your Facebook likes, is already better at predicting your personality than your coworkers, your friends, your family members. And those include siblings, parents, kids, so people who spend a good amount of time with you and observe you in different contexts. And it was marginally worse than the spouse. So back in the day, the spouse was still slightly better than the model. But again, with access to more data, more sophisticated models, it's quite conceivable that the model or like an algorithm by now would also outperform our closest confidants.
I don't like it. So I'm just going to say that. And it was funny because the other day I was fooling around with an AI tool, and I uploaded a bunch of my podcasts, a bunch of LinkedIn posts I made, some articles, scientific studies, some books. And it had the option of making a podcast for me. And I said, okay, can you make a podcast about using improvisation to better have difficult conversations? And within 5 minutes, there were these two people having a conversation back and forth, laughing, stumbling over words, talking about this stuff. Yeah. And I sent it around, and like every response a guy got was, I don't like this. So it's amazing technology, but it is upsetting in some regards to like,
yeah,
what we were talking about before of like, because you know, you can see in the case how this could be used very poorly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it also, I mean, it feels like something that is so fundamentally human, right? It's not just you talking about something, but you having a conversation, making jokes, riffing off on each other, that I think that's what's upsetting to us. But I also, actually, when I think about this future of AI kind of creating these digital twins of who we are, I'm really worried that they're going to make us somewhat more boring. Right. So there is like something, if I think about the way that large language models work, they're kind of optimizing for the most likely outcome. So if I was to outsource all of my decision making to an AI and I ask it, well, what color should I paint my wall in? Most likely would say something like beige, white, something that most people don't hate, right? Very unlikely it's going to say, well, it should be turquoise and yellow in stripes with like maybe pink dots. Because that's not the most likely next word in a sentence, which is what LLMs were trained for. So I'm really kind of concerned that we're becoming more boring collectively as we outsource more of our decision making to AI, and also as individuals. Because even if it understands me, right, even if you fed it all of the data that you produce and it understands, well, maybe your wall should be colored something that's a little bit more bright and a little bit more out there, it still goes with your most likely option. So over time, it kind of squishes your Kelly universe of choices and preferences to go with what you like most of the time. So I'm just kind of concerned that it's not just that we're kind of losing this human touch that we thought was just unique to us as a species, but also that we become just so much more unidimensional and boring individually and collectively.
All right, this is a good transition. We had Olga Kazan on the podcast. She wrote a book called Me But Better. She's an Atlantic writer who attempted to change her personality. So she dug into the five big personality traits, which you talk about in the book. And I had actually at that point gone on personalityassessor.com and I took the test. Do you want to know what my personality trait numbers are?
So, let me guess. I think you are highly open-minded. I think you're very agreeable.
Yeah, 91.
Let's see. Those are the extroversion. I would say like more extroverted, but not super extreme.
75.
Yeah. Yep. conscientious is hard to tell. Let me see what's happening in the background of your room. Maybe also somewhere in the middle.
I was high.
High conscient. Yeah, I'm extremely low. It's very untypical for German, but sadly I'm not very organized. And then I would say you're somewhat emotionally stable.
Yeah, my neuroticism was in the lowest rank. So yeah. What's interesting about our previous conversation with that is you wonder if in an AI universe they're going to want to eradicate neuroticisms because they mm-hmm. see it as a purely negative when it isn't necessarily purely negative trait.
Yeah. And it's something that we, I think, fall prey to all the time when we talk about personality, right? There's some that are more socially desirable at the surface level, right? We think of, yeah, you should be emotionally stable because you kind of don't have to deal with all the stress and anxiety. And it's true that there's certain costs to the individual, but if you're constantly stressed and anxious, that's just like not really good for your health. But there's also something that's really beautiful about having a richer emotional life. If you kind of take it all the way to the extreme, people who are completely emotionally stable, they have no fluctuation. There's no happiness and there's also no sadness. So the fact that emotional life has developed in different like ways that fluctuate is actually adds to the richness of our experience. Same is true for agreeableness, for example. Most people would say, well, it's really good to be nice. But then there's also sometimes tough decisions that have to be made, right? And there's like the idea that there's one and only one profile that is desirable and that we should be aiming for, I think is that one is flawed. Now, do I think that if individuals want to lean a certain way because they for themselves want to change, like would I like to become more organized? Probably yes. And I think there are ways in which if you kind of continuously work on something, right? If you form habits, if you form routines, over time, you also integrate that into your self-concept. And AI can certainly help with that because it's not easy, right? It's not easy to change something that's a relatively dispositional tendency to behave in a certain way. So we kind of need support. And that could come in the form of therapy. That can come in the form of coaching. But not everybody has access to some of these tools. So having AI help us with some of these desires for change, whether that's personality change, whether that's certain behavior change, I think is really promising.
When we first started the podcast, you know, I called on people I knew. Brené Brown did it, and Adam Grant, a bunch of terrific people, Dan Pink. Mm-hmm. And then I started, you know, having to book beyond my extended friend group. And I remember this succinctly and distinctly that I loved this book so much, and it was called Everybody Lies, and we had Stephen Stavidovitz, right? I mean, and my son like loves this book. It has been, you know, so talk a bit about what he writes in his book and how it belongs in your book.
Yeah, no, I think Seth was one of the first people who really shout the power of data. So he was mostly looking at Google searches and trends that show up in the search queries that people make, right? And in a way, if you think about, right, coming back to this notion of an algorithm can know you better than your spouse, I think Google is the number one example that I always give. Yeah, you ask Google questions that you wouldn't even feel comfortable asking your closest friends and your spouse. So the fact that an algorithm based on your data can know you better than even the closest people is not so surprising after all. And I think where Seth started was saying, well, what do we learn about society that we didn't know about before? Because people don't always want to reveal their quirks and some of the things that they may be ashamed of when you ask them questions, all the way from sexual preferences to people's voting behavior to racism. And what he said that there is this more objective truth out there that we get when we look at people's questions, right? What is it that they search for in Google? What is it that comes to their mind that they type into the seemingly anonymous search bar that they wouldn't feel comfortable asking or telling other people? So he started at this kind of, what can data tell us about the world and society and these big shifts and trends? And I think psychologists then brought it home to the individual and saying, okay, we can learn something about how society thinks about race or thinks about voting or thinks about sex. But what does it tell us about the one individual behind the data that they generate? So we kind of took it more to the individual level.
You know, thinking about this, sitting here, I'm also thinking about the fact that another place where you can find that's not a lie is a laugh. Mm-hmm. People can't control what they laugh at, right?
Yeah.
So when we're writing our shows at Second City and we create through improvisation and conversation with the audience every night. And so everything's tested by the time it opens, right? Yeah. But so we know like 99% of you are going to laugh at the same time at this particular thing. And the ability, I was talking about this with some folks, data scientists at University of Chicago, how incredible would it be if we had like a large language model embedded in the theater, we could analyze what is it that they're all laughing at the same time every night at this minute or this hour? And what does that say about, you know, if you study that over the course of time, that's fascinating.
Yeah, because I love it, right? So the reason for why I like comedy and humor is it's those moments that you expose yourself, right? You laugh at a joke because you know you really shouldn't be laughing at it. So, but you can't help it because it's funny. So it's this moment when we kind of break out of the normative and prescriptive part of society. And it was like, okay, yeah, you got me laughing because you figured out where I would break. And like, here's something that I know it's kind of, technically I shouldn't be laughing, but I just can't help it. So I think you're right. It's like the laughing the same way as data gives us this unique window, into people's psychology and also collective psychology, right? That's what I love about comedy. It's you really figure out what gets the room laughing. And that's what makes the experience. Cause you see, like, yeah, I'm not alone laughing at the joke that I shouldn't be laughing at. So people must be kind of thinking about it in a somewhat similar way.
Yeah. And you're hiding in a group in the dark. So it's a little bit safe for you.
Unless you sit in the front row. That's absolutely terrifying.
But then only the actors can see you at that point. It's like six people and they're actors. Yeah. You did a study that predicted whether a person suffers from depression just by looking at their GPS records. How?
So for me, I mean, the mental health space, generally speaking, I think is one of the most promising when we think of data, both in terms of us being able to detect depression early. So for me, it's like one of these contexts where current reality is just absolutely horrific, because what has to happen is you have to be pretty severely depressed for you to go and see a doctor who can then diagnose you and who can try to get you out of this full depressive episode. What you'd really want is like a somewhat continuous tracking that captures these very early signals, right? Maybe you're not leaving the house as much anymore. Maybe you're not interacting with your environment as much anymore, because your depression is characterized by this kind of extensive focus on the self and like inward facing monologues that we have. So which also means that by the time you enter a depressive episode, the likelihood that you go out and seek help actually kind of gets diminished, because you're so focused on the self and you don't want to kind of now go out and seek help, which is why suicide rates still across the board are really, really high. So the idea of passively tracking some of these symptoms of maybe you're picking up the phone at night, maybe you're not sleeping as much anymore. GPS that you mentioned is, there's much less physical activity. You're not leaving the house as much anymore. We can also tap into some of these other sensors. Is like you're not making as many calls. It is much less social activity happening. And, you know, it could be nothing, right? It's not a diagnostic tool. Maybe you're just on vacation and you're enjoying the fact that you're sitting at home and not doing that much and not constantly calling and people and taking calls. But why don't you look into this? I think of it as like almost like a smoke alarm, right? It's kind of trying to detect these early signals and just alert you to them. And it's particularly helpful, at least in my opinion, for people who have a history of suffering from something like depression, right? Oftentimes, if you've kind of suffered from depression once, the likelihood that you're going to enter a depressive episode again is relatively high. Now, you could say in the moment when you're feeling better, I know that this is potentially going to happen again. And I know in that moment, I'm not going to be able to go out and get the help that I need. So why don't I nominate someone in the here and now? Maybe that's my spouse. Maybe that's a family member who can get this smoke alarm and who can get an alert when certain patterns are detected. That just because like there seems to be something off. Why don't you check in? Again, fully understanding that it's not a diagnostic tool. So for me, it's like really this idea, how do we help people detect these signs early? But also like one of the things that I think is fascinating just from a pure science perspective, like similar to Seth, is we've learned so much that we didn't know before. And like, what are some of these subtle cues that make someone kind of depressed or anxious or kind of experiencing some sort of emotional distress? And one of the things that we've learned is actually the use of first person pronouns, which is I, me, myself. So references to the self are not necessarily indication of narcissism. I still remember the researcher who was presenting this, Jamie Pennebaker, who was like a pioneer in that space, was presenting it at a conference. And he was just asking the audience, a room full of psychologists, like, hey, I have this, I found something, like the use of these first person pronouns is associated with this psychological dimension that we all care about. What do you think it is? And all of us guessed that it was going to be narcissism. Because if you talk about yourself all the time, well, you're probably a narcissist. Turns out it's not the case. It's actually a sign of emotional distress, something like depression and anxiety. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense, because when you feel down and you feel blue and you feel depressed, you're not thinking about the world's biggest problems, right? You're not thinking about, well, what about the trade war? What about climate change? What you think about is yourself. You think about, well, why am I feeling so bad? How do I get better? Can I even ever get better? And this inner monologue that we have with ourselves just creeps into the language that we use. And for me, it's really this fascinating way of understanding something about an individual that could be immediately helpful to them, right? Detecting depression, but also understanding something broader about how the human mind works.
Yeah, I'm at that age, like when I was a kid, the only time you go to the doctor like once a year, right? Or whatever. There was nothing. You didn't have any stuff at home like that you dealt with. And now it's completely different. Like I can take my blood pressure. And so like, I don't have to go in, or I can go to urgent care. And I've got a chart that links up the two different hospital systems are on. So everyone can talk to each other. It's kind of a miracle with regard to that. And I think what they're recognizing in these spaces is one of the things that hopefully will happen is with this advent of AI is that the doctor can actually look at you when you visit them, as opposed to typing.
Yeah,
because that's the one problem I've experienced, which is I need you to look at me. Like you're not seeing me, and then you're gonna get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, because I think usually when people talk about it, it's like, well, is AI going to place therapists? And it's like, no, probably not. But there's like certain ways in which AI can either provide access to therapy for people who don't otherwise have it. Right? There's still a huge gap in supply and demand. If you look at the current state of affairs, I think for every 100,000 people around the world looking for mental health support, there's 13 trained human professionals available to provide the support, and obviously not evenly distributed. So if you go Upper East Side, you're going to find a therapist in Manhattan. If you go somewhere else, you probably don't. And even if you are on the Upper East Side, there's something that like an AI can do to support the therapist, the same way that you described it with a doctor, right? The therapist maybe sees you once a week. That's better than once a year, but sees you once a week. And then you kind of have to remember everything that happened. You have to remember that conversation that went sour with your sister. And it's going to be in hindsight, right? You're not going to experience the raw emotion. So there's something that gets lost by kind of just talking to them once a week. And AI could totally step in these moments and say, okay, your experience is frustration right now. Why don't you just kind of tell me what it feels like and so on? And I'm going to take this to the therapist and we can analyze it together. And the same as a doctor would in like a physical space. So I totally agree that there's so much complementarity when it comes to humans and machines working together, especially in the health space.
Some years ago, we got asked to speak at a conference that our friend David Hornick runs. It's called The Lobby. And it's called The Lobby because there are no formal presentations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he's always got some gimmick. And this was that it was high school. So there was going to be high school prom, but there was also classes you could take. And my wife and Anne and I were the drama department. And so you came in and took, actually, cool. It was a comedy and improv class. But a bunch of people, we were having dinner that night, and we just learned everyone's first name. But a bunch of the folks there were former Facebook employees who had all been caught up in the Cambridge Analytica issue. So you were caught up in that as well, right?
I was caught up in that as well, not as a Facebook employee and also not as an employee of Cambridge Analytica. Many people confuse me with that because, not surprisingly, I got my PhD at Cambridge on the topic of psychological targeting. But I was so far involved in that I actually helped the journalists break the story. So they had kind of some idea of, here's a PR company that claims to have won the 2016 presidential election. Here's what they claim to have done. But is that even possible? Is it feasible? Is it just like a marketing gig that they're putting out there? So I was just talking to them a little bit about what does the science say, right? Can we make some of these predictions? Yes. Is it possible to influence behavior in that way? Yes. Can we change a diehard Hillary supporter overnight into a Trump supporter? Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, well.
So kind of, I was trying to kind of strike a balance between, oh, there is a tool that's effective, but what are the limits and what can it actually do?
You say in the book, quote, "I am concerned about fake news, but I'm more concerned about slanted news."
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so I think so. The difference between fake news and slanted news is that fake news are essentially factually inaccurate, right? So I can come up and I can put a lie out there that claims something that's not true. Slanted news are they're not necessarily factually inaccurate, but they're trying to take a certain put a certain spin on a news story. I think the one example is like a news headline that could say a doctor dies after taking COVID vaccine. Now that might be factually accurate, right? The doctor might have taken the COVID vaccine and might have died after, but it's certainly implying causality that's not necessarily there. And for me, this, like, and this is not actually my own research, but it's research by Jennifer Allen, who was at MIT and is now at NYU. And what she shows is that the impact of slanted news, so news that is not factually inaccurate, but really kind of trying to get you to believe in a certain opinion, is just so much more impactful because it's much more prevalent. So fake news, if you just take one piece of fake news and one piece of slanted news, the impact of fake news might be bigger because it's like it's a real lie and it's kind of stronger. But there's like 50 times, the impact of slanted news is 50 times bigger just because there's so much more of that. And the reason for why I'm a lot more worried about the slanted news is not just the fact that it's more prevalent. It's also much, much harder to regulate and to content moderate, right? I could imagine a world where we say, if we all agree that something is factually inaccurate, should be taken down. And again, you might fall on different sides of this argument, but I could see us finding a way to regulating this. Slanted news is pretty much impossible to regulate in a way that doesn't infringe on like the First Amendment, right? Because it's not inaccurate. It's just like someone's spin and someone's opinion, but it's still polarizing in a way that kind of makes us drift apart. So that's why where this comes from.
And that extends also to our like propaganda, right? And you talk about this in the book that propaganda has been around forever. And when it was on radio or television, it was a very one size fits all because it kind of has to be and it's out in the open.
Yeah.
And the problem we have now with the psychological targeting is that it is personalized and in the dark.
It's scale. It's right. It kind of combines the scale of mass media back in the day that was a one size fits all, and it combines the personalization of typical offline face to face conversations. And what makes it even more dangerous, which is what you just mentioned, is that we don't even see it anymore, right? So back in the day, propaganda was at least out in the open, and we could meet in the town square and we could debate it. Now I don't even know what you're seeing because I don't see what pops up on your use feed and you don't see what pops up on mine. So this idea of a town square where we have a debate around what is true, what is not true is by definition so, so much harder because we just don't have visibility into some of the things that we see, that are not mass media on CNBC or Fox News.
Well, and I mean, it feels like we're feeling the effects of that right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is what is happening in this moment, which is people are like, how are we living in these two different worlds? And I'm like, we're living in billions of different worlds, apparently, because, yeah, you know, there isn't the norms are gone. There's not common understandings. We're anti-science, but we haven't replaced it with something else unless we're just replacing it with our gut. And we all know how great that's going to turn out.
Well, actually, that's next book. So I think he talks about how we should be replacing gut feeling with data. But the interesting part for me is that it doesn't have to be that way, right? So there's no natural law that says the moment that we use AI and machine learning, we end up in a world that kind of separates us. Because on some level, it's just because what we're optimizing for attention and we're optimizing, there's a, there's like this framework for how kind of, well, individuals learn and humanity learns, or like species learn. And it's kind of this trade-off between exploitation and exploration. So this idea that oftentimes we exploit on the options that we know we like, right? Think about you deciding to go for dinner tonight. You could either pick a restaurant that you know you like. That would be like exploiting, because you have a preference and you know it's going to be good. There's not going to be any surprises. But you might not get to experience anything new or find something that is even better than that one restaurant. So that would be the exploration. And right now, algorithms are very much optimizing for exploitation, but they don't really bake any discovery into the process. But again, it's not a natural law. There's so many ways in which we could say, hey, why don't I use the insights that I get from my algorithms to say, I'm going to let Kelly hop into the reality and the echo chamber of someone else. And you can define what the characteristics of that person might be. So I think there's a lot of potential, but not in the way that we're currently optimizing.
In chapter 9, which is about creating better data ecosystem, you talk about a concept that I'd actually not heard before, which is federated learning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So talk about that and how that could be useful for this period that we're
in. It's one of the things that I wish everybody knew about, because it's one of these magical technological solutions that I think can get us around many of the challenges that we see with data in the current space. Like if you take health data that we talked about before, I think we all agree that there's so much potential to say, we kind of pool our data to better understand disease, right? So all of us kind of pool our genetic data, our medical histories, lifestyle data, anything, Fitbit data, so biometrics, and we can understand disease kind of as they develop. We can understand how to treat them based on who you are, your genetics, your lifestyle, your social demographics. So enormous potential. But I don't trust a third party to hold all of the data in one place, right? So first of all, they're now going to be the subject of data breaches potentially. So everybody's going to try and hack into them. So they have to keep the data secure in the first place. And also nobody promises me that they're not going to abuse the data either today or tomorrow under new leadership. So federated learning, what it does, it says, well, we can actually, instead of us sending our data to a central place, to a central server where models get trained, again, like similar with Netflix. Netflix can kind of train their models on a central server to improve our movie recommendations. But what we can also do is we can send the intelligence locally to a phone or to a server that belongs to us and say, instead of me sending all of my medical data to a third party, the third party can ask questions of my data, or Netflix can send the model that they've created to recommend movies to my phone, where it gets updated based on the movies that I've watched. So it becomes smarter. It learns how watching Titanic also means that you like watching Love Actually and Transformer and RoboCop. So it kind of learns something about people's preferences, but it doesn't send the raw data back to Netflix. What it sends back is just an updated model. So now we all benefit because the model over time, the master model, if you want, gets smarter because it learns from all of our individual models. So it kind of learns from the Kelly model, which movies go together. It learns from my Sandra model, which movies go together. And the master model integrates those insights, but without ever seeing the raw data. And I think it's so much potential because it breaks down this binary choice that we currently have, which is, yeah, either you can have convenience and service and better insights in the medical space, but then you have to give up your privacy and you have to give up your data and you have to trust third parties to use it in a responsible way. In federated learning, you can have both, right? You can have the best of two worlds. You can hold on to your data, but you still get the convenience, the service, the intelligence that you would have gotten only from this kind of central model before. So for me, it's really one of these solutions that, kind of assuming we do want to have the insights, we do want the convenience, we do want the service, which I think the human brain is just going for no matter what, it's a way that still protects our privacy at the core level. And you see this with 23andMe, for example, which is the latest one in the news. So 23andMe collected all of this genetic data. Now they're bankrupt and someone else is going to buy the data, right? So once your data is out there, you don't know what's going to happen with it. It would have been much, much better if there had been a way to say, I'm going to keep all of my data genetic data locally, never send it to 23andMe. They can send me their model so I can analyze it, and it can tell me all of the markers that they gave me in my fun account, but without me having to send the data to them and then hope that they're going to use it properly now and in the future.
This seems hugely important.
I agree.
I mean, this should be top of the mountain kind of discussion, because you talk in the book like people don't seem to care about their data privacy.
I don't think they don't care. I think they actually replaced the questions with a different one. One is like, is it worth it? And oftentimes the answer is yes, but that doesn't mean that you don't care. And I think people also just, the idea that they have nothing to hide is not really true, because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So I think, like, why do we still have curtains? Because we do care about privacy. Why is your phone still password protected? Because you do care about privacy. So I think it's just like people feel, well, I do have to give up privacy to get all of the other stuff. And I think as long as we make it this dichotomy, because you can either have this one or this one, people say, yeah, I guess because I constantly choose to give away my data, I don't apparently care that much about privacy. But I think at the fundamental level, it's a wrong conclusion that we draw.
Yeah, I mean, because your examples are things we can see and touch.
Yeah.
The minute you can't see and touch it, it becomes less salient.
Yeah. So it's your phone, right? Your phone. If you think about your phone in an offline equivalent, that's a stalker walking behind you 24/7, knowing exactly where you go, where you live, where you sleep, where you work, who you meet, what you do. And that person would go to jail in a heartbeat, and we would be totally creeped out. But we still have that phone in our pockets 24/7, and it knows exactly the same things about us. Just not one stalker behind us, but potentially an endless number of companies tapping into these insights.
My stalker lives in my pocket. It's not yes. It's not good. It's not good. All right. We always end the podcast asking for a yes and story. I'm terribly curious to see what yours is going to be.
It sounds like so much self-promotion, but it really was actually writing the book. I think like I was always terrified of writing a book because, you know, you put yourself out there, and I was like, what if I start writing the book and I just don't have any ideas? So it took a long time for me to not say no, but to say like, yes, and here's the terms and here's the support that I need. And here's how I want to go about this, in a sense that I want to kind of start writing these small stories for friends and family, see how it goes. And then maybe it's going to turn into that. But it felt like, it just seemed so much less daunting if I framed it as like a yes. And here's how I want to go through this experience to make sure that I enjoy it, and that something, whatever I produce, is actually aligned with what I believe in.
Yeah, I just started working on book number two, and the only reason, because I was not going to do it. I was like, nope, I'm done. Yeah. But like I got pushed from some people I love, and then I was like, okay, so how can I make this work? Well, I got two other people to help me.
Yeah.
And we're doing this sort of slow process. It's just, you know, you are yes handing yourself in a certain kind of way, but also with an understanding of yourself and what you might need, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's such a good book. It's called Mind Masters: The Data-Driven Science of Predicting and Changing Human Behavior. Sandra Matz, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a really fun conversation.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming atop of their lungs.
of your life from adulthood. No one survives.